Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. My guest today is Miranda Reinert, an essayist, zine maker, podcast host, and law school dropout from Chicago. Miranda is a co-host of the Endless Scroll podcast, and she also has a blog newsletter called Step One of a Plan, where she writes about music in a deeply personal way. Her writing is unapologetically vulnerable and at times haphazard, a radical act amongst the objective stiffness of modern-day music journalism. Miranda and I have a deep discussion about the music that is precious to her and why she always makes a point to harp on the idea of objectivity in her writing. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. Welcome, first and foremost. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, of course. I love to be a guest on a podcast.
Yes, I absolutely adore your podcast, by the way. Longtime listener, first time caller, as they say. But before we like fully get into it, would you like to start by telling me what your name is, what time it is, and where you are?
Of course. So my name is Miranda Reinert. It is 6.02 p.m. I am in my parents' house in a suburb of Chicago.
Very cool. What suburb?
It's called Bolingbrook. It's where I grew up.
And you're in the process of moving somewhere right now, right?
Yeah, so I am moving to Chicago, but my previous apartment in Philadelphia, for some reason, the lease ended on the 25th instead of going to the end of the month, and I'm not really sure why, but my new apartment lease doesn't start until the 1st, so I'm in limbo at my parents' house with all of my packed up items. It doesn't really make sense, like, I don't know. When I looked at the lease, just like to look at the like move out process and just like information, I was like, oh, it ends the 25th. And it was fine for like my roommate because their lease started at the beginning of the month because their partner's old lease like ended earlier than ours. So it didn't matter for my roommate, Eric, who, if you listen to the podcast, is Eric from the podcast. But my lease doesn't start until the time that we're recording this doesn't start until the end of this week. So I'm between apartments. But that's okay. I hang out with my parents. Whatever.
And so you're moving back to Chicago from Philadelphia. That's my understanding. Is that correct?
It is. It is. I grew up around Chicago and then I went to college in Chicago proper, lived there for like 5 years and then moved to Philadelphia. And that's where I've lived for the last 3 years. And now I'm moving back because to me, Chicago is the greatest city in the world. It's the only place I really want to live. So I'm thrilled to be back.
I would like to start as well by asking you if you would like to speak a little bit about what you do.
Sure. So I do a podcast, which we mentioned. It's called Endless Scroll. Allegedly, it's about music and the internet and where those two things intersect. Usually, it's just about like indie rock. I do that with my three friends, Eric, Eli, and Michael. I also run a blog /newsletter that's called Step One of a Plan. There I write about music, but more so like, I don't know, it's a blog. It's about me, which is sort of an extension or started as an extension of zine making that I had done for several years. The blog started sort of in 2020 when I kind of didn't want to be going to the post office all the time to mail things out. But I also used to run a zine press thing called Wendy House Press that I put out all of my zines sort of under and did some distribution and stuff with. But now I'm working on a different publishing venture, so I've sort of shuttered my previous one. But I make zines, I do a podcast, I write a blog, I do miscellaneous music writing here and there for different publications too, but predominantly it's all sort of stuff that I do quite DIY or, you know, done with my friends. So
very nice. And so I first discovered your work through the blog / newsletter, Step One of a Plan. And I first heard about you through a good friend of mine named Lily, who I met through going to local shows all the time, just the general music sphere. I'm based in New York. And so I read in her Substack that she has called Zero Hyphenate, which, love that name. She name dropped you in a piece that she wrote about Turnstile and how she learned to ditch the idea of saying that they're objectively good and just finally stepping into a place of admitting, you know what, I kind of hate Turnstile.
Okay, yeah, and that rocks.
And she referenced your piece on objectivity in there.
Oh, sure.
And so I asked her if she wanted to provide me with like a little blurb about what makes you one of her favorite people in the writing sphere right now. And so I am going to read that to you.
Oh my God.
So here's what Lily wrote to me. Miranda Reinhart quickly became one of my favorite writers after I read her piece on Pop the Band's place in the worst days of her life. It is an ugly, scattershot piece of writing that showed me that music writing doesn't have to be stiff, formal discussions of sonic qualities and themes. Music writing could be about contextualizing the art within yourself, as she does with juxtaposing the aimless quality of returning home, unsure of where she is, to the unraveling of Pop the Band. Her music writing is the best writing on music because it's not music writing.
That's incredibly flattering. I am that piece. I think like that like term, like very like ugly. I think like a lot of my favorite writing that I've done is like kind of in that vein where it's very like, because I think like particularly coming out of like an interest in like emo and punk music, it's like this like very visceral quality. And I think I really like ugly music, like music that like feels kind of like grimy and like I'm really compelled by that feeling. And I think with Pup, I have that very much that experience. I think that's really interesting and flattering assessment of that piece particularly, but also of my writing, you know. And, you know, to me, the best music writing is stuff that's not music writing. It's why I like, I don't know, some older like Dan Ozzie writing, and I like Comet Bus zines. It's a lot of it's very contextual, very personal and intimate, and like the way that like music in like is entwined in your life is like so much of what like I like about music and what I like talking about music. So much more than like criticism.
Right. And I think what makes your work really cool is how, to reference what I said earlier, non-objective it is. Like you're very, it's very entwined with how it affects you emotionally, whether or not something that I thought was really like revealing that you wrote in the Pup piece was that it's music like any other music. Like you put it on to get in touch with however you're feeling, but that Pup isn't really precious to you exactly. And there are very few bands that are precious to you.
Right.
Would you like to talk a little bit about that idea of having like that really rare connection with a band that really goes beyond surface level?
Yeah, sure. So I think like for me, So relatively recently, there was like a little bit of discussion online about like how music shouldn't be seen as something with like you like as a utility, like And that's more in context of like streaming stuff and, you know, like, you know, or like when people are talking about like albums as like these things that are meant to be taken in all at once as like pieces of art and like heralded as like one thing. I like kind of don't believe that necessarily, because I don't necessarily believe that that's the best way to engage with music. It's certainly not the way that I engage with music most of the time. And the like the depth with which I can engage with music is typically best found on like a song level and collecting like, you know, interest in a band through like an emotional connection with like collections of songs. And it's why, like, you know, Cassio Tone for the Painfully Alone or Advanced Bass, like both of those projects, like Owen Ashworth's music, are like so like deeply important to me, because I think they're sort of, not that his albums don't have like always, you know, it's not like they never have an overarching theme or whatever, but they're so like self-contained songs. Like his writing is so much in self-contained songs that like I find that really easy to connect with. Pup is an interesting band because like I do feel like I like live my life to that band a lot more than I do most others, and finding a real connection with their music through like, you know, that piece is kind of dramatically titled like "And the Worst Days of My Life," but I really do feel like that's what I gravitate to when I am like feeling kind of bad. I listen to Pup and I am able to like connect with it in a way that, you know, isn't special. Like I think a lot of people, that's like what Pup's band kind of is what Stephen Babcock's lyrics are. I think that's really special. But I think like different bands, like all of my like bands that I consider my favorite bands or whatever, are kind of, they do kind of serve different purposes, and the like utility of them is, you know, different. And I find so much depth in like the way that they live in my life that like it's difficult to separate them from that like connection, that like very much like lived in connection. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm just sort of ranting about like stuff that I really like and objectivity, or subjectivity rather. It's very personal. That's what like makes me like, it's kind of tough for me to like, and I don't think this is like the wrong way to engage with art. I don't think there is a wrong way to engage with art, but I really find it tough to like the feeling of wanting to listen to so like more and more music just to have listened to a lot of music, like listening to music for the sake of creating an opinion. I find that like a really alienating thing. And I think a lot of like people who are really into music, like this like voracious need to listen to more and more new stuff. Like, I think I used to feel that when I was younger, and now I really don't. Like, it's so much more important to me to like really connect with something and live with it. And I get a lot more out of that path than the like, I have to listen to all the new records this week, which is very, very tough. And I don't think you should do it, because I don't think you're going to enjoy yourself. Like, I don't think that's like, unless you are like a music journalist whose job is to keep up with music, I think that's a dead mission. I think that's ridiculous.
I am so glad you feel that way, because I would just bleed myself dry, just digging. Like, I have to listen to everything. I have to find whatever. I have to consume all of it. Like, I have to go this far back in history. Yep. I have to do this many deep Discog dives, and I have to stay on top of everything that's been rolling out this week on on the Pitchfork like best of list or whatever. And I was just like, and I would just,
it makes
like,
you hate music.
It makes you, I was like, you know, I feel numb. I connect with nothing. This means nothing to me. I feel nothing. Like, yeah, it makes you hate music. Exactly.
It makes you hate music. It makes music like a chore. It's like you're giving yourself homework, like so much homework, and you kind of like lose sight of like, why am I even doing this? Like, the podcast that I do, Endless Scroll, we like sort of have like changed the format of the podcast a couple of times over the last couple of years. Because at some point it was like, I can't listen to 3 albums a week for the podcast. And like us trying to pick out stuff that was like both like we were interested in, we thought we would have like things to say about, it became like this like chore that made the podcast like a really like not fun thing to do. Especially like we do it twice a week and it's just like exhausting if you aren't like interested in what you're doing. And like, you know, doing that, like I'm not going to also then have like a good time listening to stuff that maybe we aren't covering. And that made me like really made me like struggle with enjoying music at all. Just like that internal pressure to be like, well, I have to listen to this because if I don't, then I'm like not knowledgeable about music or that I'm not like going to be able to say something of value about music. It's, I don't know, it like weighs on you and it really like degraded my experience with music. And I don't think I'm alone. I feel like a lot of people feel that way because like most of us aren't, you know, staffed music writers who have to like, where like that's your job is to be up on music. Like, if you're not meant to do that, like how are you gonna, you're not gonna be able to enjoy music that way. It's like if you were like, okay, I have to go to a museum every single day. And I have to go have like a valuable experience with art every single day. And I have to be looking at new artists. I have to be remembering stuff about them. I have to be looking at their old work. It's like, that's not how you engage. I don't think that's a valuable way for most people to engage with art. I really don't think that.
It really isn't. And also, like, when having you on, I wanted to come up with, like, a fun way to talk about music and your stuff that's really precious to you that was more substantive than asking, you know, oh, what do you like, you know?
Right.
So I made, like, a little bulleted list of specific scenarios that formulate connections to certain music with you. So the first one is, what is the quintessential band that soundtracks your car rides right now?
So the first thing that came to mind, I think, is probably Drug Church. I like, I don't know, Loud and Fast and just like trying to, also because I can listen to all their records kind of front to back and it's fine and I don't really find myself wanting to skip around too much, but also just because like it's fun sing-along music, at least like Cheer and Hygiene are both like fun sing-along music for me. And, you know, it's fun, it's fast, great car music. On the first side of the flip side of that, I really like driving, listening to Self Defense Family, which is Patrick Kinlan's other band. These were the two things that came to mind first. And I don't know if it's because they have the same singer, but they do. Which Self Defense is a little bit more like, if I'm trying to focus, it like, one time I drove to Pittsburgh and all I did was listen, like the western half of Pennsylvania is tough for me because I'm from Illinois. And if anytime I'm driving on like anywhere with hills or mountains or curves, I get really stressed out. And so I was trying to focus. And so I was just listening to like really sort of tense self-defense music because that band, I feel like it's really like, they do a lot of repetition. It's like almost like meditative for me to listen to them, but it's not boring and it like toes that line really well for me if I'm trying to really focus while driving. Otherwise, bomb the music industry. Those are my 3 picks.
I had my mom watch the BTMI documentary Never Get Tired when I visited her, and you know that one scene where Jeff is just like shouting into the mic and then just like and doing takes again and again and again over and over again. And then my dad just came home from a doctor's appointment at that moment and then walked in and then just sees like deranged screaming guy on the TV, just like with no context. And just like, what are you? Okay.
Bomb music industry is that documentary. When a boyfriend that I had when he and I broke up, he couldn't leave because we were living together. And so the night that we broke up, the next day I was supposed to be leaving to go back to Chicago, but that night that we broke up, we were kind of just sitting around in our apartment, and then he was like, do you want to watch the Bomb the Music Industry documentary? And we did. We just sat there and watched the Bomb the Music Industry documentary. And it was like the worst choice for us to be. Just the worst. Yeah, let's watch this documentary about like a band we both love. A documentary you've both mm-hmm. seen a bunch of times. So it's not like we're that engaged, just sitting silently for hours. I think about that a lot. I laugh every time. Just like an absurd choice to make.
Yeah. The vibe must have been off as soon as you turned it off.
It was tense. The vibe was weird. But also it's like kind of funny, so you kind of laugh, and then it's like a little bit weirder because you're kind of laughing together, and yeah, it was bizarre.
So the next question I have is, what is a no longer active band that you wish would reunite?
So the only pick for me for this one is Everyone Everywhere, who are an emo band from Philadelphia. And I don't think they ever will. And I'm not like too broken up about it, but they're like the first band that I remember finding, like when I was like 15 or 16, probably 16, 2013. I'm like, this is a great band. It had come up on like my Spotify, like radio or whatever at the time. And then I went on Tumblr and I saw that they had played their last show like 2 days before I like found the band. And it was like the first time that I was like, oh my God, I missed something. Like I like truly like just have missed out and like just barely. But awesome band. I wish I could have seen them play. Mm. Now, do I think it would be valuable for me to see them play? I don't know. I don't know that I would have as much of a, you know, a big feeling about it. But boy, do I remember the feeling of being like, damn, like I just found this band that only has like a couple albums. And now they're done, like immediately done.
What is a band, other than Pup, obviously, that has soundtracked the most pivotal years of your life?
Probably like Into It Over It. Into It Over It is sort of like the way that I found a lot of like the emo that I really liked when I was younger, and I mean even now. And I met like the guy that I dated for a long time. I met him at a Into It Over It show. I like have seen Evan Weiss play probably more than anybody else. Like, to me, like, his music is so much, like, I think his music is, like, synonymous with Chicago for me. Mm-hmm. And because I feel that way, you know, it gets entwined with, like, moving to new apartments in the city and, like, you know, when I was going to college, his albums coming out and going to see him play and, like, finally being old enough to go to like New Year's Eve shows he always played and like that kind of stuff that really sort of like soundtracks so much of my life, and particularly like moments of like transit in my life when things are sort of changing a lot, I fall back into listening to Into It Over It because it feels very like comforting to me.
I totally understand like the feeling of comfort because
yeah,
that's how I felt about a lot of the music that I listened to during 2020 lockdown. And you know, it sort of makes you, I definitely got the fallback on like, so I was, for instance, I was listening to a lot of like Yeah Yeah Yeahs, which and I was listening to even a lot of like old Taylor Swift records. And what is a band who tests your limits of comfort?
I really struggle with stuff that's like really sort of slow, pretty, like almost like ambient leaning stuff. I picked out like Cassandra Jenkins, but anything sort of in that vein that is like takes a lot of patience. I feel like I don't listen to a lot of music that is like quite slow and like sort of builds into something really subtly. I don't listen to a lot of subtle music. So I struggle with that. And Cassandra Jenkins, I really love. I think her music is beautiful. But it took me until I like saw her play live to really be able to access that, because it is so like uncomfortable for me to sit in like something that's very subtle and very like layered, and for the interest of the music to be in that as opposed to something very in your face, because so much music I really love is very in your face. And that like really immediately connects with me in a way that stuff that sort of falls on the other end of the spectrum really doesn't. Famously, I struggle with Big Thief. I feel very uncomfortable with a lot of their music. I really don't like it. But also, like, I really like seeing them play live. So it's really that tension for me is like uncomfortable a little bit. But yeah, anything where it takes kind of a lot of like focus and patience to really like lock into it is difficult for me. Not always like not worth it, or like not even that I don't like it. It just like does feel like, or like inspires a sort of tension in me that I don't typically lean toward. But usually if I can see something like that played live, I'll enjoy it a lot more, which I don't know.
Yeah, that whole studio to live sort of transcendence thing is definitely mm-hmm. a phenomenon that I think a lot of people experience. Like when it's like, mm-hmm. I don't really care for this, but if I see it live or even watch a video of them live,
right.
like it's enjoyable. Like it's pretty amazing how like context and the time mm-hmm. and place can really like transform like a connection to something. It's wild.
Yeah, totally. I feel the same way about like a lot of hardcore. Like if I see that played live, I usually get it a little bit more. Sort of stuff like on both ends of like that loudness spectrum, or to, I guess, inadvertently quote Turnstile, gotta see it live to get it.
And what is one specific record label that really did a good job of cultivating a sound that defined your formative years?
Sure. My adolescence, it's probably like Run for Cover or Top Shelf Records, as someone who was into very emo revival stuff and the sort of hardcore adjacent alt-rocky stuff that Run for Cover was doing when I was in high school. I think those are probably like the most formative labels for me. I don't know what I would consider something now, or like, I don't know, when I was a little bit older. I think like Side One Dummy for a while was like when Pup and Jeff Rosenstock and like the Gaslight Anthem was on there, you know, before they like imploded like 4 years ago or 4 or 5 years ago. I'd listen to anything Side One Dummy had put out. But then they collapsed, and who knows?
I'm not very familiar with, like, the history and the lore. So you said Side One Dummy collapsed?
Yeah, well, they, like, fired all of their employees and then, like, stopped putting out... Like, Jeff Rosenstock moved to Polyvinyl. Pup put out stuff with, like, Rise Records or something, and like all of their like big current big artists ended up moving to other labels. They stopped putting out new music. They were like doing reissues for a little while. I think it was just like financial stuff, like financial mismanagement, I think, is probably the, like with most labels, I think this is speculation, I really don't know. I just know that they fired all their employees and all their bands that I liked all moved on to different stuff. Though recently they've started putting out other stuff. The like new Walter Etc. album is coming out through Side One Dummy, which I think is like the first like really new thing that they've put out in a while. But I imagine it's just finance stuff. Most label troubles end up boiling down to financial mismanagement of some kind.
That's normally the case, yeah. And another question I noted down, mm-hmm. which I'm really interested to hear. What is a controversial hot take that you have on a scene or a band mm-hmm. that music heads or music nerds might find like surprising?
Sure. Okay. So recently it was brought up that the Strokes, like most popular songs on Spotify, none of them are from the first album. And I feel, not that numbers on Spotify streaming is like the end all be all of what's important about music, but I do feel slight vindication because I think their first record's super boring. I like don't get why it's like all the songs, there's like two kinds of songs on that album, and it's just like there's like two perfect songs and then eight repeats of like worse versions of those two songs. And I just like, I don't get it. I think Room on Fire is a far superior record. I think it's a more interesting album. It's like every song on Is This It is like good, but they all sound like almost identical. It's an album that is only good if you're like, you're like in the car with people and you don't really know what they like to listen to. You can put on Is This It and it'll be okay, probably. But like, it's not their best album. Far from their best album. I don't think any perfect album can have only good songs on it. I think to make like a great record, you have to have songs that are like a swing. And I don't think there are any on that album. I think all of them sound exactly the same. And that makes them all fine, but that's boring to me. Room on Fire, much better record.
I feel so vindicated that you agree with my take that Room on Fire is a far superior record.
So good. And it's a, I think it's a fucking perfect record, but like, it's just so much more interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's so much better. I love it.
I know Sofia Coppola is a big Strokes head too. Like, mm-hmm. So I would like to think she agrees with us.
Yes. I don't know. It's so weird. Like, I don't know. I just don't know how you could not think Room on Fire is the better record. I just don't like, Is This It is fine. Like, it's okay. Like, I like the songs. I like whatever, like for the most part, like, but like, I don't know. They all sound the same.
Do you know what I think it is? Is I think a big thing that canonized the whole Is This It is their only good record talking point was the fact that like this band was bought and paid for by the media and by all the major labels. There was a massive bidding war over them. So I think people sort of have this Stockholm syndrome tied to like, well, that was when they were at their peak, therefore only their first record could be good.
Yeah.
And because the only reviews we remember about Room on Fire are the ones that were like, it's just Is This It part two, why are they doing this again? Then like people are like, oh, well, okay, because that happened at that time.
Yeah.
This is the only good album and I am right. Because I associate that with this or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
I also think like people are so obsessed with being right and like being like having all of their opinions be like bulletproof. And I think that like Is This It is like the Strokes like bulletproof album because it's like for like the reasons that I think it's kind of boring. People like love to be like, this is the objectively best record.
Oh, here
I
we
harp
go.
On objectivity all the time. It's just like so stupid. I just think it's, I think it's ridiculous. I think like, I think it's way more interesting to be someone who's like loves music and has like, not a like contrarian take for the sake of being contrarian, but like, I don't know, the obsession with canon and like, especially like very much like online music nerd type stuff. Like this, like, well, I need to listen to the top 100 albums on Rate Your Music and then I'll know about music. Or like, I need to read all the Pitchfork reviews and then I'll know about music. Or I need to argue with Pitchfork because I know more about music. Like that whole thing, like, I find that really tiresome and like a really impersonal way to engage with it.
Basically, like what you're saying is if I become a sheep in the herd, then I must be right.
Right, well, because nobody can disagree with me.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody can disagree with me. And then it's, that means I'm right because all of this other stuff backs me up. And it's like, it's not a history paper. It's mm-hmm. not a book report. Let's go. Come on. Have like an opinion. Not just like disagreeing right. with someone for the sake of disagreeing, but like what compels you to this for real other than, well, these other people said it was really important, so I have to think it's really important too.
Right.
Think yeah. for yourself. Enjoy the Strokes album that you love.
Yeah. I'll die on this hill. Angles is a fucking great album. I don't care. I don't care how
good songs on there.
Yeah. I don't care how tumultuous their relationship was at the time. Like, if songs are good. But so another talking point I prepared for us was
mm-hmm.
Orgcore.
Orgcore. My cross to bear is explaining Orgcore. Because I wrote a piece about it, and now I'm like, if you Google Orgcore, like, that's what comes up. And it's music that I love, but it's more like a sort of era of melodic punk music for the most part that, like, is interesting to me more. And I think it's more because it's, like, sort of the tail end of a time in the internet, like forum internet, sort of pre 2013, like internet times. Oh my god, my dog is barking. Stop. Sorry. So I think what's interesting to me about Orgcore, yeah, is this, like, it being this era of the internet that's sort of just before what I was really online a lot for. And it's, I don't know. It's genre-wise, it's just like melodic punk music of a certain time. Stuff that was enjoyed and highly rated by the writers of punknews.org. A website I never use. Like, I don't know. Like, they're in the depths of their comment sections, and the people who use their stuff, use their site, just the stuff that they liked. But I think it's interesting to look at sort of that as, like, not really a genre in truth, more of a scene, more of a, like, an internet scene in a way that I don't really think we have now. Not with such, like, fierce interest in, like, a pretty narrow lane of music. I think internet communities online now are, like, interested a little bit more in being, like, more well-rounded music fans, more, I don't want to say, like, generalists, but kind of, like, generalists. I think, like, some genres hold on to that a little bit more. Like hardcore, I think, ends up being a little bit more narrow. Like, people who are into hardcore and into talking about hardcore and hardcore culture very much exist in a lane of their own. But I don't think that rock music otherwise really does. And orgcore and, like, punk new stuff of that era kind of does live very much, or did live kind of in its own sphere. And it's like, oh, they'd all go to Fest in Gainesville, and they'd all, like, I don't know, all had strong opinions about Against Me signing to a major label and like, you know, punk shit. But this, like, post-zine culture, but pre, like, Tumblr, Twitter sort of time period is, like, really interesting to me. And a lot of the music that I really love comes from that, at least in part. At least could be argued that it comes from that in part. You know, like the Menzingers and Latterman and that kind of stuff. And, you know, and it's the reason that I, like, people who are, like, big into that sort of scene, it's, like, the reason that I really love, like, the Weaker Thans and, you know, meeting those people. And they're, like, you know, it's kind of a kind of guy, right? Like, a kind of person who really likes this stuff. And they have Strike Anywhere tattoos and Against Me tattoos. And it's, like, gruff dude culture. But they all also, like, really love the Weaker Thans. And that's, like, we get one emotional band. And everything else, it's about drinking beer and going to Gainesville to get sick. but now I have to explain what OrgCorp is all the time, which is fine by me, but it is like the funniest like thing that has come out of writing my newsletter is this like one piece that, because if you Google OrgCorp, it comes up, and like, or like at the end of year with like Spotify's like Spotify Wrapped, OrgCorp comes up as a genre.
Oh.
And people don't know what it is. And then I get tagged at the end of the last like 2 years, I get tagged overwhelmingly as people get faced with a word they don't recognize. And people are like, read this piece. That piece is like 3,800 words. You shouldn't read it. But but it's so funny to get constantly tagged at the end of the year with people trying to explain what OrgCorp is to their friends who had it on their Spotify Wrapped.
That's hilarious. Now I bet like every time the year-end Spotify Wrapped, like, and everyone, do you just turn off your notifications and mute everyone now?
Well, I think last year at some point I ended up muting the word OrgCorp for a little while. I don't mind it. I think it's flattering to be like tagged, and like it's weird to like have something that people like strangers like link to and like remember. I think that's like a really flattering thing, especially as someone who like, I don't know, I like the blog is kind of like 90% of what I do. And so it's flattering to me. I'm not like a staff writer-y type who like does a ton of work. So I'm typically happy to, you know, it doesn't matter if I get like the notifications. It's mostly flattering, and it's good for my traffic for my blog too. So there's also that.
And another question I wanted to ask you was about zines.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you feel like zines are still important? And I mean, we could make this argument about like physical media as a whole, but, and so why do you feel like zines are something that stand the test of time in DIY culture?
So I think you saying stand the test of time, I think it's because they do. I think like digital media, as pervasive as it is incredibly fragile if you don't intentionally maintain it. It is an active process to keep a blog accessible. It is an active process to maintain like having your domain and, you know, archiving your work is so important. I think like what's valuable about having something physical is that it is like, every zine I've ever made sits on a shelf, and it will sit on a shelf for years. And if I wanted to pick it up, I can. And I don't have to pay for a domain every year, and I don't have to make sure that like in 5 years something is accessible to other people, something that I don't think about, you know, like physical media, you know, of course, paper degrades. My zine won't be around in however long, but like it is important to maintain record of especially like DIY culture type stuff, especially as it pivots to being more based on platforms that like do not value you, or like writing for. Every time I talk about this, I bring up that like you can't access AV Club articles from like, 5 years ago.
Hmm.
And it's like, it's nuts because, you know, when I was in high school or like early college, reading the AV Club, reading David Anthony's work at the AV Club particularly was like like huge as far as me wanting to write about music, wanting to listen to music, knowing about music. His work is like so valuable to me, and I can't read a lot of it anymore. The articles will, like, you can load the page, but it's broken. It's like you can hardly read it at all. Some stuff's just gone. A lot of blogs from the past are just gone, and people didn't like archive it. They like, it's just gone. So, and if you didn't make the intentional choice to, you know, keep your work, to archive your work, like there is no, like, it's just gone online. And physical media doesn't necessarily like fully solve that problem, but it is something I value about like making it and, you know, collecting this stuff that I have. There's also an aspect of like the way that I write a zine. I think the way that most people write zines, the way that I would write that and the way that I write a blog is inherently different. One, there is like a brevity aspect. I think there is like the way that you have to write to fit stuff on a page is going to be different than if you're like writing a blog where it kind of doesn't matter how long you go, or if you're, you know, other self-directed forms of like online writing, I don't think have that same, like in the back of your mind, you don't have to think about how long your piece is. With physical stuff, you do. And I think that's a value. I think like practicing brevity, I think is valuable and important, especially if you're someone who mainly does very like DIY stuff. I think I also tend to think more about how, like, if I'm writing a piece that's going to be like, I'm going to print it and send it to people, I would like to know that, like, if I send this piece to someone in 5 years, it will still read as clear and like interesting and valuable as it did in the moment. The internet is so much about like being topical and being, you know, this is the new album that's out this week, or this is what like people were talking about online this week. And I love that type of writing. I think that's valuable types of writing. And I think the internet is good for it. But practicing writing stuff that has like a little bit of a broader scope, that's a little bit more evergreen, I think like is good. I think like it's good to sort of put, as someone who makes, you know, physical media, put my brain into that mode, which is sort of how I differentiate between stuff that I will like post on my blog or my newsletter versus like stuff that I'll put in a zine or put, you know, in something that's going to be physical. I also don't make like a serialized zine. I don't like, it's not like Maximum Rock and Roll or whatever. Like it's, there are mostly like one-off things that are more in the style of like personal zines. But so if you make like a different kind of zine, it's a little bit different, but I think just the, those things are sort of like my main thoughts. I also just think that like making stuff is cool, and it like, you know, if I make a zine with, like I did one a few years ago with my friend and writer Danielle Chalosky. We did like a anniversary piece or an anniversary zine for Title Fight's album Shed, and a bunch of people contributed to it, and we printed them and sent them out, and it's almost like a like a physical marker of stuff that I mostly do online, and it brings this online aspect of my life into a real world. Like I like mailing stuff to people. I like having like, I like, and I like getting stuff in the mail. I like physical media because I think it takes this thing that's either very internal or something that's very online and brings it into your real life in a really tangible way. And I think that, like, you know, emotionally is really important and valuable. I think like that's true of making stuff and sending it. It's also true of buying it and like why I like get vinyl, and it's like it's this like physical manifestation of this thing that is a huge part of my life. but isn't necessarily always like a tangible part of my life. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's why it's different. I don't think that, like, you know, I think so many people like pit like physical and digital media sort of against each other, but I think it's much more valuable to view them as like serving different purposes and living in your life in different ways. And that's what I like about them both. I think they serve purposes for me that are so different. And I love both of it. And I think it's just different. I think like holding something in your hand that is like designed well, something that like feels good, like something that is cool and like connects you to someone in, like, you know, for the first like 2 years that I made zines, I was mostly writing about like English bands, like British bands. And so I mailed a bunch of zines to the UK for like 2 years. And then I like went to some like festival in England, or like a like an all-dayer type fest in England, and like met people that like knew my work because I mailed a bunch of zines to the UK. And that's like something really beautiful and real that like I wouldn't have if I wasn't making physical media necessarily. It's like this, I don't know, it's something really intimate and different than what the internet provides. And also, I don't have to buy a domain for it, really. So for them to still be in people's homes and in mine.
I love that. Yeah. I love it's really important to recognize when, like you said, something serves a different purpose than mm-hmm. another.
Yeah.
And that whole idea of, like, you know, when you're in school and you're given all these like specific like training courses on like, or like mm-hmm. like programs that are like DARE or DARE adjacent, like sure. Like you put something up on the internet, it's there forever. That's not necessarily true though, because like you said, yeah. So many of these web pages like just get completely obliterated because they're operating on such a fragile software like system. And so like when people say like the internet is forever, like I don't know.
The internet is forever, like the stuff that people want to keep around. Mm-hmm. Like the internet is forever, like, you know, like porn is forever probably, because that's something that like there is a vested interest in keeping it there, you know. But that's, there's like blogs are gone, even like, yeah, big websites, it's like impossible to read stuff. It just like, it's especially the last few years when things have really started to more than a few years really started to like tank, it's tough to not feel like we've lost so much culture. I mean, even just like the absolute punk forums are gone. It's like, okay, that's like a culture. Like, that's just wiped from the internet. It's crazy. It's more than anything, I want people to archive their stuff, at least online. Do it yourself. Fingers crossed the Internet Archive survives all of the problems they're being faced with. Because, like, without it, like, I couldn't have written the OrgCorp piece that I wrote. Like, so much of that is based in, like, the Internet Archive. And, I mean, there's more of it that isn't accessible because it's older than 10 years old. Like, anything, trying to look on the internet for anything pre, like, 2012, nightmare. You can't do it.
Yeah. Gotta phone your friend the Wayback Machine.
Exactly right. And even then, sometimes not. It's a bummer. It I care deeply about physical media because I think like I can read a zine from 1998 and I can't read a website from 1998.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even zines can sometimes like be barred from being accessible because mm-hmm. so many of them were donated yeah. to university libraries.
Yeah. Terrible. And like university libraries that like don't have the resources to digitize their stuff because you know, one time I said something like negative about that particularly online and librarians got mad at me. I know that it's because they don't have the resources. Digitizing is like a hefty process, but like an archiving is a hefty process. And a lot of those places don't have the funds to dedicate to it. And it's, you know, this disinterest in a preservation of culture is like so depressing to me.
It is. It is depressing. Yeah. But that's why it's important to archive your stuff.
Archive your own stuff. Don't leave it to someone else. You cannot trust anybody else.
Exactly.
That's bad advice in the general space, but good advice in the archiving of your own workspace.
Exactly. Well, I think a good note to end on would be to have some chatter about like the Jeff show at Baby's All Right.
Oh my God, yeah.
So what gave it away for you, since it was a secret show? Was it that maybe for me, the fact that he just tweeted the ticket link?
Oh yeah, I think that was the first flag. I thought, because I was like, okay, so Jeff's definitely going to play. I was wondering if there was going to be like something else like special happen, but it was just a Jeff show. And that was beautiful and great. I also knew that I was moving. Sorry, probably I wasn't going to be in Philly for a long time. And the thing about living in Philly is that you can get to New York easily. So I was like, well, I'll just do like kind of more impulsive, like I want to go up there and I want to go to the show and hang out because I don't know if I'll make it up to New York again. And I did once after the show, but sort of trying to make the most of living on the East Coast while I did.
Mm. Yeah, that was a really fun show.
It was so cool. It was great to see him in like that kind of space.
Definitely.
I was very excited to get to see him play in like a small space because I really don't think I've ever seen him play at something that small. I saw him play at a weird, in like 2018, I saw the band play it's a place called Logan Square Auditorium, which I think is mostly like a wedding reception space. There's like big windows and it's like not that big of a space, but it was weird because it was bright through the first two bands because there's windows up there and like it's on like the second floor of, there's like shops on the first level and then there's like, it's like on the second floor of it. It's almost like a VFW hall, but like, I don't know, intended, I think, for like wedding receptions. Because Chicago's all ages situation is a little bit weird. And I think that was what they were trying to do, was just play all ages spaces. Very weird. Really fun show. Martha opened. Probably the only time I'll ever see that band play. That band will never play in the United States ever again. Awesome show. Again, still bigger than the Baby's All Right show, though. So that was really cool and fun. It was cool to have like one good special New York experience while I lived on the East Coast.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. And so I think that wraps up everything I wrote down in this hefty Google Doc here. Thank you so much, Miranda, for coming on. This was so fun.
Oh my God. Thank you for having me. I love to go on podcasts that I don't have to then deal with. Well, I guess I don't do the production stuff on my podcast, but just being able to come on and just chat is always fun.
Thank you for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you so much once again to Miranda Reinert for joining me for such a thoughtful and insightful discussion today. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy. Bye.